So this Shamatha practice that we just did is a sort of a different way of doing things than we've kind of perhaps grown accustomed to on insight meditation groups. So I would be interested to know what the nature of your experience was in doing this practice, you know, relative to insight practice as you may have been more accustomed to doing it up until now. It's like a midterm exam question, you know, compare and contrast. But it would be beneficial for me to know sort of, you know, how it was for you to do this alternative approach. Please.
I found, assuming I did it correctly, I wasn't entirely sure, but initially it sort of helped me not do what I usually do, and that's obsess on an everyday thing, you know, traffic coming down or something.
Mm-hmm.
That was the effect early on in my meditation, but it slowly wound back to the usual everyday nonsense.
Mm-hmm. Well, and to the first part of your thank you, for the first part of your comment, there's no way to meditate wrong. Some ways turn out to be more difficult, but it's usually just through practice that you come to discover the ways that you may have been making things more difficult for yourself than you needed to, and that. What you're describing is a very common experience that people have when they're doing a shamatha practice, especially if you don't do it very much, if you're doing it sort of for the first time, is, you know, arousing the intention to experience the spacious nature of mind. And you can kind of do it, you can sustain it for a while, and all of a sudden the discursive mind cuts in and says, well, that was fun, but now we're going to get back to the real, you know. Real business here, you know. No pain, no gain, damn it. And so it's a different approach, and that's why partway through I'm always trying to find that balance point between, you know, giving periodic instruction and allowing you to just experience whatever it is you're experiencing. But when I found that exactly the same thing was happening for me, which is that, you know, the distractions were sort of crowding back in. Then remembering to consciously use the breathing to do what you can to reestablish that sense of spaciousness can be quite helpful, as long as it doesn't get at some point to become like some kind of a struggle where it's like, you know, you're trying to keep things at bay that really want to come in and grab your attention. It's easier to practice, number one. And, you know, the Buddha, within the images that he used, the guided meditations, the visualizations, he was trying to find words that people could relate to subjectively describe what it is that's going on. You know, the neuroscientists that are studying, you know, the brain on meditation these days are saying, well, you know, when the discursive mind is in the driver's seat, there are these very well-established neural patterns, you know, that just sort of keep firing, you know, kind of linear in nature, certain trains of thought, you know, or kind of choo-choo trains of, you know, thoughts and emotions and memories and plans and whatnot that tend to follow each other along. When you're doing a shamanic-style meditation practice, you're really kind of trying to stimulate the parasympathetic nervous system, which tends to be much more diffuse in nature. And when the samadhi gets really deep, what the brain scanners are telling us is that the superior parietal lobe of the brain begins to go dark. There's a lot of activity in the prefrontal lobe, much less up here. It's the part of the brain that orients one in space. You know, here I am, discrete being relative to the space that I'm in, and also discerns boundaries between self and other. So when the samadhi gets really deep, those mental functions begin to relax and fade and become softer. And so literally, there can be this sense of spaciousness, you know, of the boundaries not being so evident, or of the sensory inputs or the mental inputs being sort of softer, less intrusive. And because we're training the mind, training the consciousness to experience itself in a different way than it usually does, oftentimes it turns into this kind of ping-pong match between a certain amount of the mental energy resting in this open, spacious place, and then the other side kicks in for a while and whatnot. It's like the flow of conscious energy is like going down one set of pathways for a while, and it gradually tries these others, and you can almost kind of feel the tension that can arise when you're basically inclining the mind toward spaciousness and relaxation, while at the same time its habitual patterns are trying to kick in. And then that becomes the nature of the meditation experience, you know. And once the mind becomes calmer, there it's like the babushkas, you know, it's like then there's a bigger state of consciousness within which you can see that struggle going on, right? And so, but gradually what's happening is that literally, you know, the mind's just getting bigger. Joseph Goldstein does a meditation, somewhat like this, called Big Mind Meditation. It's based on Tibetan visualization practice, but it's the same intention. This is just the one that the Buddha happened to teach with regard to deep samadhi practices. Thank you. Please.
It was really helpful, and partly because one of the ways I can get in the way of myself during meditation is by giving myself a hard time for all of these extraneous thoughts to come up.
Mm-hmm.
And having a little structure of mm-hmm. being able to breathe in, breathe out, mm-hmm. and it's in a way, it was kind of a way of reminding myself that it was okay.
Mm-hmm.
So that was really helpful.
Yeah, good, thank you. It's a good practice to do when you're well rested, because otherwise you can put you to sleep. was that your experience, Ruth?
After my nap, I was fine. After my nap, I was, maybe your voice was like a bedtime story, you know? But I thought, I just didn't get my nap this afternoon, right? but then I really like that kind of practice.
Sure,
and
of course.
It's really helpful. I like it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's so interesting that you mentioned ping pong game and babushka doll, because mm-hmm. at the end, when you invited the light mm-hmm. and the expansion of the light, I could see the sort of exterior boundaries of my head, and I could envision this expanding light within my kind of mental state that was bound by my head mm-hmm. somehow. But then I could visualize beyond that a great deal of expansive light. And then sometimes the border that was sort of me, my mind, would sort of waver and begin to dissolve, but then it would come right back again, you know. And so I felt this definite, you know, ping pong games, sort of mm-hmm. like my mind was trying to keep itself in my head where I always
yes.
picture it. And the light was all just in there. I was okay to be there. But then this other light that I kept trying to expand on sort of outside of it. So it was just an interesting tension in those two spaces.
In the greater discourse on the establishing of mindfulness, the Buddha actually talks about that very thing. And he, in terms of the cultivation of the observing quality of mind, that the meditator, and I was basically talking about sort of informed or wise consciousness, knows the expanded mind to be the expanded mind. And by that, what he meant was this consciousness seeking to expand beyond the boundaries of self. And in fact, in the teaching, the deep samadhi practices, the visualization that the Buddha used was this, you know, the place where we were, the spaciousness, the silence, the stillness that can become immersive and pervasive, so that it kind of becomes who we are slash who we're not. And then the next meditative absorption after that one is one in which the boundaries of self actually dissolve and consciousness expands outward into the universe. And so that's basically how we went out, was just offering some of the imagery that he used for talking about when the mind becomes so calm, the boundaries of self dissolve, and when it simply rejoins, goes back to the source. This is imagery that, by and large, one finds much more often in the Vajrayana tradition, the Tibetan tradition, or to some extent in the Zen tradition. You find that kind of language a lot in the Mahayana texts, talk about spaciousness and emptiness and whatnot, but it's actually every bit as much a part of the Theravada teachings. It's just that the Buddha normally discusses it when he's talking about a deep samadhi. Yeah. But it's all in there. Yes, please. Thank you. I felt that too, actually. It's like, okay, here we are in this very interesting, quiet, still place together. Yeah. Yeah. And it's the power of collective effort. We're all inclining our minds in that way. It's good. Other people's experience. Please.
Yeah, I've done the isolation flotation tanks, and my mind immediately went there. I was just thinking how intense it would be to use this imagery in the tank. Might be a little too intense for me.
Right. I remember reading some of the early history of the experimentation with the tanks when they were trying to figure out what it was going to be like for astronauts to be in deep space for long periods of time, or relative absence of stimuli and whatnot, and they put them in those tanks. And at least the first research I read said, yeah, these are like seasoned fighter pilots. People had been up against anything. They'd gone through these terrible experiments on pain thresholds and stuff. None of them could stay in the tank more than 6 hours. That was as long as any of them could do it. And it was very interesting. Some of the things and some of the similarities and things they reported when they came out, demonic images were pretty common. Mm-hmm. And they actually wound up bearing some similarities, some, as they sketch them out or discuss them, some similarities to the fierce deities in Tibetan Dakas. That there was a place the mind was going, and was saying, wow, what's going on here? Because they were basically experiencing dissolution itself, but without context, without much understanding of what it was that was going on. For that matter, the experimenters didn't necessarily know either. They were just kind of curious to find out. But that's one of the, that's why the deep samadhi practice is something that, certainly the Buddha and all those who have taught it down through the ages have really recommended be done incrementally and respectfully and with someone who is experienced in those teachings, because when you do a lot of deep practice, retreat practice or others, eventually there is this phenomenon that tends to arise where the mind actually gets relaxed enough that at various points in time, there are just these, actually it comes almost kind of as an instant recognition of something that just happened, where the mind has ceased constructing the self, and you kind of experience what it's like to still be in a body and still be conscious, but not processing everything from the self-referential point of view. Zen is called Satori. In Theravada Buddhism, anatta, experience of not-self. And it tends to be kind of comes and goes. Now you see it, now you don't. Sometimes it can last for longer periods of time. The issue or the problem, I think, and this was also a really frequent one for people that took psychedelics without being in an appropriate setting, that good setting, is that what happens, all of a sudden the self's gone and it's terrifying. You know, they don't know where it went or if it's coming back, or, you know, they feel there's this feeling of tremendous vulnerability, you know, or fear, anxiety that can happen. Which is why, and you know, like Ram Dass, who tripped hundreds of times by the time he started spiritual teaching, you know, he was basically kind of saying the same thing. He said people are dropping large quantities of psychedelics or on a quest for that experience, basically. But so you can chemically drive the mind to that place or have that experience. But if you're not doing it with appropriate context, without some way of understanding what's going on, it can be quite shattering and quite terrifying. So that's why in the Buddha's teachings, he's pretty careful to try to say, okay, you know, you do these practices, eventually this is the threshold to which they're going to take you. And it's beneficial to know that early on, so that, you know, if you find yourself drawing near to that place, or if you find yourself in that space, you won't be alarmed. You know, you'll understand what's going on, which is basically you're beginning to experience the truth of the Buddha's teaching that the mind creates the self. You know, that's not a permanent abiding entity. And if that's something you've already kind of clicked to, you know, it's like, you know, yeah, I've been getting hosed this whole time. Of course, that makes perfect sense. Then if you sort of have that experience, it just, you know, kind of falls into place and you just kind of experience the truth of that teaching. If on the other hand it's something that's you're quite resistant to, or that you come at by chemical or mechanical means, it can be pretty disturbing. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Other people's experience. There are texts that do a nice job of pointing out the value and the importance of allowing oneself periodically to cultivate this view and to have this understanding. One of my favorites that I know a lot of you have heard me reading here is from the Tao Te Ching, where it says, "We join spokes together in a wheel, but it is the center hole that makes the wagon move. We shape clay into a pot, but it's the emptiness inside that holds whatever we want. We hammer wood for a house, but it is the inner space that makes it livable. We work with being, but non-being is what we use." So, you know, like Joseph Monet that said, "I don't paint things, I paint the space between them." No. So, what we're doing is coming to have some regard for a sense of absence, a sense of emptiness, a sense of spaciousness, you know, that's not always filled with memories and plans and afflictive emotions and delightful emotions and bodily sensations that we judge to be pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, and the behavior of others that we judge to be pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, that it's like when Joseph calls it the mind that contains all things and yet is not made up of them. You know, that we are coming to have some appreciation for the ability of the mind to rest in this place of openness where it's not necessary to order things in a particular way or have things be in a certain way, but allow just for things to be as they are in your mind, and have some understanding that there is no wrong way to do this. There are ways that can present more difficulty than others, but that to some extent, you know, things are unfolding as they should. It can be kind of confidence building, actually, in a way, to every once in a while, instead of just doing watching the arising and passing and whatnot in insight meditation, to say, you know, it's not cheating, it's not going on vacation or anything, I must reaffirm to you that this is an entire realm of practice that the Buddha taught because he thought it was really important, you know, just to not do, just be, you know, just be with the mind in this open and relaxed way. In the sense and meaning, the verses on the faith mind from the third Zen elder, a Chinese philosopher named Seng Sen. The way is perfect, like vast space, where nothing is lacking and nothing is in excess. Indeed, it is due to our choosing to accept or reject that we do not see the true nature of things. Do not, this is one of my favorites, do not search for the truth, only cease to cherish opinions. Just let things be in their own way, and there will be neither coming nor going. Obey the nature of things, your own true nature, and you will live freely and undisturbed. The wise strive to no goals, but the foolish fetter themselves. There is one Dharma, not many. Distinctions arise from the clinging needs of the ignorant. To seek mind with a discursive mind is the greatest of all mistakes. I don't know about you, I've been there a lot. You know, it's the only tool that for many years we knew how to work with, you know, the discursive inquiry. And it can be incredibly valuable, you know, in terms of the cultivation of various insights and whatnot, but it has its limitations. And what the Shalva practices like this are about is ways to be with the self and the non-self and the mind writ large that go beyond the capacity of the discursive mind to understand, to experience. So we're, in a way, kind of hanging out or relaxing into the infinite within ourselves. Okay, so the eternal within ourselves. You know, and the Buddha would talk about the deathless. He was talking, and he would speak about the deathless. Someone asked him, what do you mean when you use this term? You know? And what he would say in response is, that which was never born can never die. And so in some ways, what he was conveying is that our ability to understand and to take in and to appreciate the vastness of things as they are and our inseparability, you know, that self and other at one important level is illusory, right? We literally are all in this together because we are what's happening, right? That when it's possible to take in the world from that view, you're not taking in the world from the view of a discrete self. Okay. So if the mind is continuously birthing the self, okay, the mind gives birth to the self and the self experiences life, it experiences and names things it likes and that it doesn't like and people it likes and people it doesn't like and the political leaders it likes and doesn't like and strives for this, that, or the other thing to attain something or to avoid something, and then that self dies. So the mind has to create another one. Okay. But what the Buddha was saying is there is a way to be in the world that is not made up of this endless round of births and deaths and rebirths that the mind is continually up to. You know, that to experience the world, to experience yourself and others from the view of not self is to experience the deathless. Because you're experiencing life not from the point of view of a self that was born, but you more become an exercise in the universe looking at itself. Okay. it's not easy to, you know, necessarily get your head around that, but that's exactly where he's coming from. Yeah. please.
Well, I think that one thing you said in the beginning part of the guided meditation that triggered a shift in me from thinking about what you were saying, mm-hmm. when you said sensing consciousness. And for some reason, those two words sort of released my mind from constructing this idea of consciousness as this lily pad floating just under the surface. Because suddenly this, that just sort of left, and I started to sense by using my senses. It wasn't so much a mental thing. And that's when I kind of realized that, you know, in order to do this, I really need my body. You know?
Yeah.
I can't, my mind can't do it. You know, I need the senses. You know, so that's when I sort of went in and I was aware of this sense, this sensation and that sensation as for as con, I don't know, I mean, I can't talk about beyond that, but yeah, the sensing consciousness.
Mm-hmm. The Tibetans used to paint pictures about that. The great wheel of life, the wheel of samsara, of dependent origination, you know. One sector in that is, it shows two guys in a boat, and it's nama rupa, name and form. It's basically making the same point that you just did, which is to say that mind and body are related, they're not the same thing, but they're not separate. That for us to experience the world as we do, we experience it through this fathom long body, that's the Buddha used to call it. You know, it is the repository of the apparatus for experiencing things that they are. And you know, as I don't know if you ever put it quite this way, but as many others have, it's the means, and Alan Watts used to talk about this all the time. It's the means by which the universe seeks to experience itself. You know, we are that means. And the better we get at experiencing ourselves, which is to say, experiencing the universe as it is, the likelier we are to behave in ways that don't cause all creation to suffer, because we don't experience ourselves as being separate from the rest of creation. Yeah. So, being able to allow the mind to relax into that kind of spaciousness from time to time has some real tangible benefits. Turns out, we live our lives, it's not all just do well. You know, there really is a discernible and positive relationship between being able to hang out in that space and how we are with each other in the world.
Mm-hmm. I was just thinking of a line from the poem by Gilpin in the collection of poems to God, and I can't remember the exact words, but it was something, I desire to be able to sing you, he said. Mm-hmm. And he wasn't talking to singing about you or being a, even it was more thoroughgoing than being a vehicle for, you know, what he called God.
Yes.
So when I express myself, for that to be an expression of God, I think he would have been comfortable with me.
Very much so, yeah. And like Rilke, Jalaluddin Rumi, a lot of his poetry as well, it's like you can read them on multiple levels, you know, in one way they just sound like love poems, but in some ways they're love poems to the universe, you know, to the vastness of creation, the mind of God, you know, if you were to use this language. Okay. Thank you. Okay. Other reflections or sharing views? Okay. Well, in terms of spaciousness and emptiness, personally, I don't feel the need to fill the next half hour with talking. If what is said needs to be said is said. So Why don't we sit together in silence for a few minutes? Emptiness here and emptiness there, but the infinite universe stands always before your eyes, infinitely large and infinitely small, no difference, for definitions have vanished and no boundaries are to be seen. Have a good week.